I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Film Fandango. This podcast is sponsored by Her Film Project, an organisation that helps unheard voices to make films. Why not support them by going to @HerFilmProject on Twitter and following them, or checking out their website, herfilmproject.com. Now, this is a more serious start to the podcast than usual, because I have some sad news, which is that having spoken to the normal host, David Reed, who was on paternity leave, we have decided that Film Fandango is to come to an end after pretty much 6.5 years on 300 and so episodes. This will not be the last episode. There will be 4 more, including this one. The reason we've decided to stop doing it is because it is a lot of work, and we both want to pursue other projects. David Reed will be doing his Inside the Comedian very funny podcast, and I'm going to start a new podcast called Marek Makes a Movie, in which I'll be talking to filmmakers, which is something I'm interested in, and then making a film using the donations, if there are any, or what they are, to make a feature film or a film of some sort. And I'll put details of those on our Facebook and Twitter. Meanwhile, I would like to very much thank all our listeners over the years for being so supportive, and anyone who's written letters in, and especially to those people who've donated to the podcast, which has helped us to carry on for so long. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoy these last few episodes, and we're doing another podcast, so don't be upset. Anyway, that's the announcement, and let's carry on with this week's episode. Hello, listeners. Welcome to what is now going to be one of the last for a while Film Fandangos. But this week I'm lucky enough to have an old friend as a guest. Many of you, actually probably about less than 1% of you, may have seen a film called Magicians, in which I made my film debut approximately 10 years ago and have not been in a film since. My fellow stooge, who we had an interesting time filming that with, lives locally, and we met whilst in the cinema, whilst going to see Star Wars. It is my friend Tim Plester. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Marek. Hello. I hadn't seen you for a while, and now we were both compelled to go and watch
Star Wars.
Star Wars, because there was nothing else on, and also I feel an obligation as a child of the 70s to turn up and give it my money every year, but I think I'm going to stop.
The anger I saw.
Furious.
Yeah, you didn't hold back. I think there was a few expletives,
yeah, probably.
But there's no choice. We were just talking before we started about having to do a new film every week, and that there's no way you can escape Star Wars unless you go to art house films. But what is interesting is, in terms of people listeners, a lot more people listen to the Star Wars review.
Well, of course, naturally they will do. That's what you're up against. Even the art house cinemas have to show Star Wars at Christmas.
It is because of Star Wars that this podcast is dying.
Well, no, it's but why we're doing this, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have seen you there.
Yes.
and we wouldn't have arranged to do this.
This is the only good that's come out of Star Wars.
Thank you, Star Wars. Yes.
Did I say Star Wars? I can't know what I said. Anyway, would you have happy memories of magicians, Tim?
I do, yes.
All I remember is the magician with the silver face. Called Magibot.
Magibot, yeah.
And we referred to Mr. Fucking Silver. Someone
Had said that to him. Because we were filming, it was the day we were filming in Nottingham, at the theatre there. And somebody had shouted at him across the car park, and then he recounted this to us of, "Oi, Mr. Fucking Silverface," or something. So that amused us greatly, I remember. But that kept us going for a long time.
Yeah.
And I was actually back in Nottingham last year, and I found myself in an Indian restaurant opposite that theatre.
Oh, really?
The first time I'd been back, so I was kind of reliving the magician days.
The dream.
It was a dream, and I wish we'd gone into this Indian restaurant when we were there in Nottingham, because on the wall was a rogues gallery of people who had been in.
Oh, really?
They were all there. Bob Carroll G's had been in. The guy from 3-2-1, Ted Rogers. I mean, it was quality.
All were 1970s.
Quality stuff. Michael Praed, the first Robin of Sherwood. They were all up on the wall with their signatures, and it was... I could have stayed in there for hours.
Anyone who'd been in there?
Hank Marvin.
Really?
Yeah, oh, God, they were all there.
So that must have been the only place open after that. They'd done a gig at the Nottingham... Was Nottingham Playhouse, was it?
Nottingham Playhouse, yeah. You told me... I always remember bumping into you in the street in Crouch End a while back, and you told me... Because Peter Capaldi was in Magicians.
Yeah, yeah.
And you said you used to occasionally run into him at the gym.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember this story, but you used to, this was when he was doing Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And you used to amusingly say to him, "How's it going? Up to anything at the moment?
Yeah.
Is it busy?"
Yeah, yeah. He used to, Peter Capaldi, so he used to sit in the gym, and it's that weird thing of when you do a job and someone talks to you afterwards, and then years go by and you see each other less frequently, and then that talk sort of just goes to a smile and then a nod. And then he lives around the corner from me. And I mean, our careers can have gone on from more different paths. And now he nods to me now. It's gone down to a nod.
You still get the nod, though?
I still get the nod. He was a very polite man. He came and introduced himself to us while we were playing Top Trumps, I believe.
That's true, yeah. We were playing, yeah. What trumps were we playing? We might have been playing Top Trumps.
It might have been either Marvel or Horror.
The classic horror one. Yeah, yeah. I do have a good collection of those.
Have you?
And I've got some great actual Doctor Who trumps as well.
The artwork on the horror ones was great. Yeah. Actually, there's one who looked like he was killing someone who looked like my dad. I found really Talon. I think he was called
Talon. Scared the living.
It had a man in it. It looked exactly like my dad when I was that age, and I found that really traumatising.
I thought for a second you might be saying the jailer.
Oh, but jailer.
He was scary as well.
A jailer's scary, but rubbish.
Rubbish,
points.
But
yeah.
Scary to look at. Death. No, can you remember him with the little, the really sharp fingernail? He's quite close up. You're right in his face.
Yeah.
He's yellow.
It was equivalent of those YouTube videos where something jumps out into your face. That was the equivalent of that.
I think he had a death rating of 100 or something. He was a good one to get. 99.
Yeah.
He was top.
There are horrific pictures for...
I'm going to have to get those.
Would you let
later.
Your... How
no.
old? You've got a four-year-old.
Four? No. No way.
What age would you play those Top Trumps with him?
At least another year.
Yeah.
Five, maybe.
Five.
I'd probably take the jailer out.
Yeah. I didn't find the jailer that scary.
There's something, I think he's hunchbacked. It's maybe, I'd have to look at it.
If there's an element of truth about the jailer, that's what makes him more scary. That's what I got talent. I thought that could be my dad. I mean, you could talk about those horror Top Trumps for at least two episodes.
He's pecking someone's neck, isn't he?
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, okay. Is that that guy looks like your dad, or Talon looks like your dad?
No, the guy he was pecking looked like my dad in around 1982. So very
Which is
different
when
now.
The pack was, you know, when you've been playing it as well.
When it was in schools, when everyone said it's the first kid to bring him in. Great
well,
stuff.
I'd love it. If you see Capaldi again, you know, you're still getting the nod.
Ask him what he's up to.
Yeah, what are you up to now? How's that thing going down in Wales? Is that still happening?
Yeah.
Are you not doing it anymore? What happened? They sack you. It's not going, it's not happening anymore, the Welsh thing.
Did you ever watch Doctor Who? Or do you watch Doctor Who?
I watch it sporadically. I mean, I was a big fan of it as a kid, and then I really enjoyed Matt Smith when he was
to
watch those. Certainly the first series that he did, I thought he was fantastic. And then I kind of dip in occasionally, and I always like to watch a regeneration. So
yeah, they're good bits, aren't they? Before you knew, or when it before. Well, Peter Davison was just at the end of Tom Baker, Peter Davison.
Yes, yeah, I liked a bit of Davison.
Yeah.
Then it went a bit wrong, didn't it?
Yeah, he was shit. What's his name?
The other Baker.
Baker, and next to his shit.
And then we'll get McCoy after that.
Don't talk about him. Anyway.
We're a bit off topic, though.
This is what happens with this thing.
Good.
So, first of all, so I met Tim, and then Tim said that his film, his documentary, was showing on at the Crouch End Pitch House. So today's podcast is going to be, we're going to talk a bit about that, and then we're going to talk about three billboards in Ebbing, Missouri as well. So we'll talk about those two.
Not a real place, Merrick.
Really?
No, it's not a real place.
That's good, isn't it?
That may have... Has that tarnished your thinking about
not
the film?
Not really.
Yeah, all right.
But let's talk about The Ballad of Shirley Collins, first of all.
Yes.
So you made... This is your second documentary.
Yes, second documentary, feature-length documentary that I've made with my co-director, Rob Curry. The first one was called Way of the Morris, which came out in 2011. And it's taken us this long to make a second.
Why is it taking you so long? Just because life, children, or funding?
I would say it's probably all three of those. Yeah, so I've got a four-year-old daughter now. Rob's got two kids. So that, takes a certain amount of time up. Funding is always problematic when you're, chipping away at the bottom of the pyramid. And it also took... that long because of the nature of the story of the Ballad of Shirley Collins, which so Shirley Collins, for those of you who don't know, which is probably most of you, is 83 years old now, and she was a big cheese in the folk music scene in the 60s and the 70s in this country, in the UK. And then she lost her voice in 1980, she lost her voice and kind of disappeared. And while she was away from the limelight, her interest in her grew and her records became very collectible, and a whole new generation of people kind of came forward and discovered her music, even though she wasn't recording anymore. So we originally set out... So it is connected to Way of the Morris. What's different about the Ballad of Shirley Collins to anything else that we've made before is that we were actually approached to make the
Ballad of Shirley Collins. I was wondering to ask you how you found a fascinating subject like that, and if you approached her. Because I'll just quickly say, the Way of the Morris is basically about your family roots in Morris dancing.
Yes, in Oxfordshire.
And you follow the Adley... Adderbury Village dancers.
Yes.
And there's something about both of these films which is really great, it's always weird when you go and see someone's documentary and think, oh, am I going to like this or not? I really loved it. I really love both of them. And they feel, we talked about this a bit before, but really quintessentially sort of English, and it's really hard to be... English without crossing that line of, because especially all the whole Brexit thing of being sort of, you can't put a St George's cross without being, if you see that in a window, it's racist.
Right wing politics.
And this this really reminded me sort of growing up in the sort of 70s and 80s and that whole sort of weird country sort of villagey sort of type thing where nothing really happens. So people just do weird things. But they both felt quite calm. After watching, when you go spend a day at the beach or go for a walk in the country, I felt as if I'd gone for a walk in the country after watching both of these documentaries, and I felt soothed by the sort of, I don't know what it is, which is a really nice feeling that you feel soothed by it, where it's all the stills you use and the sort of beautiful vistas. But anyway, that's sort of a bit of background. So you got approached to do Shirley Collins then?
Yeah, so... a music promoter called John McMahon, who'd been working with Shirley, because when she wasn't recording music, she was still doing talks about music and the roots of music. gypsy music, this trip that she went on in 1959 with an American ethnomusicologist called Alan Lomax, which is
that
part
is,
of
our
story.
That's incredible, isn't it?
So she would be talking, she would do talks about this, and John was involved with that. And John was who had the idea of, you know, basically thinking somebody should make a film about Shirley. And he'd seen Way of the Morris, and Shirley had seen Way of the Morris as well, which was what was great about it. So when he then approached a producer called Paul Williams, and Paul Williams knew me and Rob and mentioned this, it all kind of fell into place that we'd made Way of the Morris, Shirley had seen that and loved it, and thus, if anyone was going to make a film about her, she was happy for it to be me and Rob.
Ah, and that explains a lot, that how you get that. So I wanted you to approach her. I suppose if you have to make that first documentary to get that trust, so I people mean, know you're going to do see a project through and have that feel and a sort of
it helps
sincerity or better, or sort of, I don't know, trustworthiness. I don't know what it is.
No, I mean it really helps. I think if you've got something you can show somebody to say, well, look, this is what we did before. This is, you know, this is our CV, if you like.
Yeah.
Please, you know, trust us to do right by you. And I think what was helpful about Way of the Morris is because it was my family, that was actually quite an easy film to make in terms of earning people's trust, because
yeah.
they all knew me. They were, you know, literally my family or family friends who I'd known my whole life. So that was never a problem with that. I mean, it was different with Shirley, because even though she trusted us, she was a different kettle of fish in terms of, you know, she wasn't related to me, and I, you know, I didn't really know her. Plus, she is somebody who's written a she has written her own biography.
Okay.
So she has quite a clear idea of her public persona and how she wants to present herself. And actually making The Ballad of Shirley Collins, a lot of that time that we spent making it was trying to ascertain ways of, if you like, short-circuiting pat responses that she had to questions.
Yeah, yeah.
She was used to being asked the same question again and again and again, and so she had a standard response to it. And over time, when we went to see her do things and hear her talk to other people, me and Rob would look at each other and go, that's the fourth time I've heard that exact same anecdote, even the inflections, the pauses are literally the
yeah.
same. So how do we try and get beyond that?
That was fascinating when you had to taking her to her old places and sort of seeing her when she, because she sort of tries to sing again, doesn't she?
Yes.
And yeah. then when you see someone under in a difficult I always think it's fascinating to see someone in an uncomfortable situation, because you get to see the vulnerability of her and all the emotions she's going through, and then suddenly it gives it so much more depth. I always think when you watch TV programmes now compared to the 70s and 80s, when you had kids on there and they didn't know how to act on TV,
yes.
so you get these really pure responses, and now yeah. you see yeah. children being taught, and they're so media savvy and so used to being in front of the camera,
yeah.
they know you don't get any, it's really hard to break through that. So how did you...
I mean, that is something you come up against making documentaries as well, is that... and we try. I mean, so what we try to do with Ballad of Shirley Collins is, at no point are we, in a traditional sense, behind the camera, asking a question of Shirley, who was sat in front of the camera looking into the lens. We kind of try
yeah.
to avoid that approach, and so we chose a succession of people for her to talk to have conversations with in front of the camera instead. So Stuart Lee is in there, who's a big Shirley Collins fan, and then there are a couple of folk musicians, one called Sam Amadon, another called Elle Osborne, and then there's another musician called David Tibet, who's part of an apocalyptic folk outfit.
He's incredible.
Current 93. He's quite something, is David. And so we tried to engineer situations where she would be having a conversation, much like we are, having a conversation
yeah.
with somebody, rather than feeling like she was being interviewed. Because I think the minute you do that, the minute you stick a camera in somebody's face and ask them a question, people just, you do behave differently.
Yeah, your voice changes, the whole thing. And also, it's great to get footage of when people who feel relaxed, people they know, because then their behaviour changes a lot, and you get these snippets of conversations which are
yeah.
sort of genuine, rather than just someone trying to be polite to someone or make a good impression.
I mean, the great thing about, you know, the to shift. My kind of filmmaking career goes back beyond the documentaries to short films that I made before that, and the first shorts that I made were on actual film, 16mm. Shot a couple of shorts on 35mm, which is insane and very costly. But this shift into digital, what it has its advantages with, certainly with a documentary, I think, is that you can film for a long time and hopefully get a sense of them kind of forgetting you're in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
You can get to that, and people are relaxed, and you're not so precious about burning film and getting, we've got to get this now in.
Yeah, I mean, the film is terrifying. I'm about to do some student film. I think I might have talked about before, where some bloke, and I've got one role, and I didn't realise it was on film, and I hadn't really learnt this speech properly. And thinking, well, I cannot make a mistake on this 3-minute monologue, and I'm the wrong actor to choose for a 3-minute monologue.
Digital is revolutionised documentary in that sense, I think.
But on the other sort of side of the coin, you end up shooting. I bet you shoot tons. And I mean, how long did it take to make, and how long did it take to edit? It must have taken. I make a 5-minute YouTube video with my dad, and the more I do it, the more I realise. I think I need to get that shot. I need to get that shot. And especially when you're
didn't get enough coverage.
Then when you do work with people, you know what coverage you need, and you're working with someone who's not used to being or doesn't understand how films work, you're just thinking, just say that in one fucking sentence.
Yeah.
But going through 45 minutes and just waiting for them just to think, have I got it? And then there'll be some sound problem. I can imagine the horror making this of sitting for hours and hours of stuff.
There is that, you say, can we do that again, please? And it's like, well, didn't you get it that time? Well, kind of, but not all of it.
Yeah.
And also, it was out of focus, or it's all, you know, with a documentary, you can have a few more rough edges. It's a bit more forgiving in that way. But, I mean, we shot hours and hours and hours of we totally overshot.
So how long was this filming start to finish process?
So the whole making of the film took 3.5 years.
Wow.
Of mine and Rob's life and Shirley's life. There's two reasons why it takes that long. I mean, one was to do with the funding, that we originally did a Kickstarter campaign, which was very successful, and we got a nice lump sum to start the whole process. But that went ultimately, and then we would have to kind of wait and get little pots of money from here and there to be able to afford to do another day or 2 days filming. So that's another reason why it took a long time. But it also took a long time because actually, and this is essential to the film that we've ended up making, is that Shirley's story changed as we were making it as well. So we set out originally to make a film about a singer who didn't sing.
Yeah.
And over the course of those 3.5 years, Shirley decides that she wants to try and sing again, and then starts to record this album, which is called Lodestar, ultimately, the album that she records and was released back end of, not last year, 2016. It came out the back end of 2016.
And did really well.
Did really well, you know, critically acclaimed, all of that stuff. She went out on tour with it as well, which again, she hadn't recorded an album for 37 years.
That's incredible.
Which is insane.
And so, yeah, I think we'll talk more about that also the new podcast I'm doing is called Merritt Makes a Movie, which you can find, I'll tweet details about, and I'm going to talk to Tim in more depth about Shirley Collins and the making of it and the sort of more sort of technical aspects and difficulties of being a documentary maker. This is showing now at... You've got what screenings has it got?
Well, we premiered at London Film Festival in October, which was great. You know, really happy with that. It was a kind of launching platform for the film. We always hoped that that would be where we'd launch. Partly to do with, you know, the English nature of the film. We felt we wanted to definitely premiere here, and the London Film Festival is the best one you can get into in this country. And then off the back of that, we did a cinema release, which we've been organising ourselves. We self-distributed the film. And then the screening that you saw was part of the Picture House Discover Tuesday strand that they do. So we were delighted that they picked us for their first Discover Tuesday of this year. And it's been touring all over the country since October, really. I mean, I was in Birmingham. I said it like it was Birmingham, Alabama.
You sound like you're American, Birmingham.
Birmingham. I was in Birmingham last night for a screening. And I went. I did an MA in Birmingham 20 years ago.
Really?
So it was really interesting to be back. And while the film was on, I didn't go and see the film last night. I had a walk up to the old street where I used to live and had a drink in a really nice old boozer and then walked back and did the Q&A afterwards. But so we're almost out of screenings with it, but there is one screening at the British Library this coming Saturday, which is the 19th. Saturday,
whatever, the 19th of January or 20th of January, one of those two.
This Saturday coming, 2 o'clock at the British Library. It'll be the last screening in London on the big screen. We haven't got any in diary at the moment. And what's also interesting about this British Library gig is that Shirley's there as well. And she's got a new book coming out, which she's going to read extracts from and talk about that. And then in the evening, she's going to play live as well.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a nice little Shirley Collins Saturday, and that'll be a kind of a nice send off for the film. And then the DVD will be out there later in.
What platform would you put on? You're going to. Because Where the Morris, which is I really loved, you can get on Vimeo.
Yes, that's on Vimeo. There is also a DVD which has been re released at the end of last year, so you can get it on DVD. And Shirley will be, it's actually going to be, this happened with Where the Morris as well for a month, Lush, the cosmetics company.
Yeah.
They have a Lush player online. Yes, the Lush player.
What a weird thing to do.
Oh, have a look, there's some good stuff on there. And Where the Morris was the first film they'd ever streamed on it. And as a result of that, they're going to stream The Ballad of Shirley Collins as well for a month, starting, I think, immediately after the screening on Saturday. I think it goes live on the Lush player.
So Lush player?
It's just the Lush player, yeah.
And people pay to go and see it on that?
No, it's free.
Free?
Free, my friend.
What are you getting out of it? You're getting cosmetics out of it?
I can't divulge.
I hope you're getting a lot of bath bombs.
I'm getting out of it. It's a lot of bath bombs.
1 million bath bombs.
Lifetime supply.
On sale on eBay.
Yes. Of that banana cream that you can put on.
I got a weird space one. My girlfriend got me a bath bomb.
Everybody loves Lush, don't they?
Yeah, it smells. I mean, you feel as though you don't deserve a bath bomb.
You do, Marek.
I do. But I feel like I need to save it for when I'm weird.
My daughter loves them, is the problem. So ours never.
Oh, really?
Saved, they just go in. What? Who's put this bath bomb in here? I was set. Okay. Watch it.
I remember the days of old Matey Bubble Bath, which used to give me a rash, but I still loved
still
so much
used
of
it.
Yeah,
because the bottle was so good. And get all the different characters.
The great bottles.
So you can watch it on the Lush player, and then after that, the DVD will be out. There's a soundtrack album coming out as well, so it will rumble on through this year. The Ballad of Shirley Collins.
And then, have you got an idea for what you're going to do next?
We've got a few ideas, yes.
Documentaries or films?
Me and Rob really enjoy working in the documentary format, but we'd like to twist it a little bit. We like to try and kind of, without giving, there's certain elements of The Ballad of Shirley Collins, for instance, which are not wholly documentary, one might argue.
Kind of
fabrication.
Yeah, well, which was incredible. We'll talk about it in the Marek Makes a Movie thing. But definitely go and watch that. You should see. Have you seen my favourite documentary last year? Was a half documentary, half film about the girl who got killed in a young girl, the beauty queen who got murdered.
Sounds hilarious. No,
but they do a documentary where the casting JonBenet.
Right, I don't get. No,
it's absolutely incredible. So it's a documentary maker. We talked about this before, where they go to the local town and they cast loads of actors to play Basically, this JonBenet was a beauty queen who got found murdered in this rich people's house.
Right.
And they wrote a ransom note. Apparently, she got kidnapped about 10 years ago. And they cast lots of actors to play the mother and the father and the child as if they're doing it. And then they interview the actors afterwards.
Yes.
And because they're all local, they've all got stories about who they thought and what they bring to the character. So they do the same scene with different people. As a documentary maker, I think you just think, I thought you've just taken this genre and made it absolutely fascinating. I think it's on Netflix or something, or maybe I bought it. But
that sounds right up my alley.
You would. The idea is
Louis
great.
Theroux did something similar with the one he did about Scientology. I don't know if you saw that.
I've not seen
there was
one
a bit
yet,
when he was, because they couldn't actually get access to the Stephen McVeigh, I think his name is, the kind of the head honcho. So they got actors to play him, and they showed the casting process. And And there's also a great film that I saw last year, which again I can't remember what it was called, but it was about, there was a newsreader in America in the States who shot herself.
I've heard about
TV.
Yeah.
And last year there was a biopic about it which came out with Peter Hall's daughter in it, but there was also this documentary which again had an actress playing her, and they followed her as she researched the role. And so I mean documentary in the last, I think, 5-10 years has produced the most interesting work that I've seen.
I
just think it's a bit more fluid. It's not so rigid in terms of what you're allowed to do and three-act structures and all of that stuff. Most narrative fiction seems to me to become really quite...
totally turgid and you know, there's no point, I think, something weird's going to happen.
Yeah, whereas, you know, Doc seems much more loose, and it's because that there's that one word for it, you know, there's one word, it's documentary, whereas with fiction it gets broken down into, is it a comedy, is it a drama, is it a thriller, and it's like, well, why can't documentary get broken down into different compartments?
That's
as well?
Very interesting.
So I just I think we want to continue working in this realm, but certainly not in what people probably would consider traditional documentary.
Cool. Well, there'll be more chat about this in the other podcast, but let's move on now. I'm not going to do the letters section because we've got
Christmas.
A couple. I'm saving them up for. So we're going to talk about Martin McDonagh's Three Billboards in a Field. I should really get the title right.
Ebbing, Missouri.
Ebbing, Missouri. Three Billboards in
said,
a.
It's not, it's
is it in a field or three billboards?
No, you've added that. That's getting too long.
Three billboards in a field.
I think he probably said originally a field, and an exec said,
"Mate, it's going to the amount of font space it's going to take." Yeah.
See, in a documentary, you'd be allowed to put that in a field in outside. Is it maybe it has
well,
a field
put,
outside?
You wouldn't put in a field.
It's, no, it's outside Ebbing, Missouri, but not in a field.
Let's just get this right, because I don't want people going to see the wrong film, which is has a very similar title. Which could be...
See, people thought Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was too long a title, but it's, you know...
Perfect.
Just remembered it like that.
That is a good point. Whereas I can't remember
it,
what happened
it?
To the Morgans, whatever that is. Anyway, three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. No field.
But it is in that they are in a field.
Yeah, I mean...
You've given that away.
Sorry, spoilers.
The billboards are in a field. There's three of them. I could tell you that. There are three.
So don't even bother going seeing it. But you went to the premiere of this.
Yes, I did. So there is a connection to The Ballad of Shirley Collins here quite nicely, because Three Billboards was also at the London Film Festival. So because we were there with The Ballad of Shirley Collins, we got invited to the I think it was the European premiere. I think it premiered in the US.
So what, and are all the stars there, or some of them there?
Who was there? Let me think who was there. Sam Rockwell was there. Francis.
Oh, really?
Mighty so Francis herself was
all
there.
All the big cheeses.
McDonough was there. Quite a lot of them were there, I think. Little Peter Dinklage was there.
And he wants to be referred to as Little Peter Dinklage.
I can neither.
Have you met him? Because do you know him from Game of Thrones?
Well,
or not?
So interestingly, there is an interesting story about the premiere of Three Billboards outside
Ebbing,
Missouri.
It's after Ebbing,
Because Dinklage was in town for the premiere, there were a lot of Game of Thrones people outside around the red carpet. And so when I turned up to go to see the film with Rob, my co-director, people started shouting at me.
And, of course, they recognise you from...
And Rob said to me, I think there's somebody over there, you know, Tim, they're shouting your name. And I said, I don't know who that is. And then they started waving Game of Thrones stuff at me. So I actually got kind of in a bit of a kind of melange of scrummage.
Did you play one of the...
Black Walder Rivers, his name is.
Are you still alive?
No, I'm in a pie. I got killed and baked in a pie. Of course, yeah. A bit like the Blackbirds in the summer in the children's nursery rhyme. So I had a little feeding frenzy, which was I haven't encountered that often in my life, and it's quite scary, even on the small scale that I had it. I can't, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, I was saying all the time, don't worry, Dinklage is here. He is in the building. He'll be out in a minute. I can sign this if you want, but there is somebody more famous coming out in a second. In fact, Brian, I've just seen Brian Cranston. He'll be out in a second.
Please, can
I go now? I just want to go and see this film.
It's pretty horrible, isn't it, when that happens, when you're not expecting it? My own experience, I did a show called Impractical Jokers.
Yes.
Which is, and when that came out, I didn't realise that any, specifically groups of, basically be male... Black male young people would stop. I almost went over, just stopped in cars, go, me, come out. And I would just think, I mean, he's probably racist, me thinking I'm going to get mugged. You know, just see a car break and go, oi, mate, come over here. No, what the fuck? Instinctively, I'm going to run.
that comes from growing up in the 70s on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
It's still ingrained in you.
So. Luckily, everyone has forgotten.
I know that this is a purely audio medium that we're working in here, but you've got a distinctive face.
Yeah, I think people do remember,
easily spotted.
Yeah, so that's when I've my story I always tell people is when I've told this 100 times before, but I was on
101 times.
I was on the tube when my nephew came to stay with me because he had been to London, my step nephew. He was about 15, 16, he came to stay. And his show called Impractical Jokers has been out. And it's a prank show where there's... it's based on an American show, but the British version, where you have three people give instructions to the other fourth joker to go and do these pranks.
Right.
Anyway, the prank this week was to win the prank. They had an all-you-can-eat buffet they put on. And you had to go out to this buffet and steal food from people's plates. And you get a point from each item you stole from their plate. And everyone else had done it, and I walked up to this girl, and she was sort of quite a big black girl on her plate. And I just picked up her plate, and I scraped the whole thing onto my plate. And then I took the fork out of her hand, and I ate the thing off the fork, and that's so I won
you
this
won.
Task.
That's the
anyway. Way, yeah. You think that's fine? That's fine. So you got on the train. I was taking my brother back from Highgate to my step nephew to Highgate to Waterloo. I got on the train at Highgate. All the seats are taken apart from... So we're standing up. But we're the only people standing up.
Yeah.
And there are two... Further down the carriage are two youth... So you know the youth who speak like this, but they're not like... They're not black kids. They're speaking like this.
Yeah. From the hood.
From the hood. And they went, oh! There's that bloke. There's that bloke from that thing.
Yeah, mate.
And then everyone turns and look at me. And they go, there's that bloke. There's a bloke who nicked that food off that black girl's plate. There's no reference to any TV programme. He's just the guy who's nicked the food off specifically. And they kept on saying, he went up to this black girl. She's just sitting there. So it looks like I'm... And also, so I'm going red and sweating. I'm with a sort of 15-year-old...
Are they filming you as well?
No. I'm with a sort of 15, 16-year-old boy. So it looks a bit weird. So why is he with this sort of...
Yes.
And... I've just literally got no... I've shaved my head and I've got no... So I look like a... Sort of wind,
like
yeah,
a baby.
A little neo-Nazi sort of baby.
Yeah.
And then they get off Archway and everyone is just talking and just almost tutting, thinking, who is that guy who basically steals... Specifically targets black people and steals their food.
Steals food.
So I bought a... I literally dropped my nephew off, bought a baseball cap. Never get on the train without a baseball cap normally. Anyway, we are going off on a tangent.
But
so,
while we're off on this tangent, this made me think of another amusing Game of Thrones anecdote.
Go for it,
I haven't shared with anybody, really, and Stuart Lee told me this.
Yeah.
So there's a Ballad of Shirley Collins connection as well. Just now, to see what I'm doing, I keep
bringing it all back around.
So the actor, I always call him the actor Kevin Eldon, because of Fist of Fun, he was always known as the actor Kevin Eldon. Kevin Eldon's been in Game of Thrones as well, twice in fact, playing two different roles.
He's in the play one, isn't he?
He was in the last series as well.
I've not seen the last one yet. Okay. Jammy. Think of all those repeat things.
Well, so Kevin Eldon appeared in it twice. And apparently somebody came up to Kevin Eldon recently and asked him if they could get his autograph, a photo. Could you sign this, please, Kevin? And it was a photo of me. It wasn't a photo of Kevin Eldon. I don't know is whether Kevin signed it or not. If you're listening, Kevin, write in and let us know. Did you sign the picture or not? Because I don't think we look that similar, but Alan Bennett and David Hockney, think about those two for a second. Quite similar?
Yeah, I think you are.
No, but they have, those two have a written understanding.
Oh, really?
Because apparently it happens quite a lot.
Oh, really?
Hockney will get asked by somebody, oh, Mr. Bennett, could you sign this for me? They sign it. As the person
they're
not.
Wow.
There you go.
So you might have a Alan Bennett, which is actually a David Hockney.
Absolutely.
Signature somewhere.
Yeah.
They'd probably be worth more. Yeah, you want to get those.
Which also makes me think of, completely off topic, there was a period back in the 90s when the Chas and Dave Tribute Act, they're called Daz and Chave.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're still going. it was more expensive. It was more expensive to book Daz and Chave than it was to actually book the real Chas and Dave.
Wow.
It's probably not the case anymore.
I have a thing where there's I can't remember who it is, one of King Henry VIII's wives. There's a picture of her which looks exactly...
Cleves, Seymour,
Boleyn. I think it's Anne Boleyn. Is it Jane Seymour? It looks exactly like me. It literally did, especially about 10 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, Henry VIII's wives.
Marek Larwood.
So if I'd have been around then, I would have made shitloads of cash.
Just for those who...
What I'm doing...
Marek
I'm
currently looking on his iPhone. Smartphone, I shouldn't... Maybe can't say.
There we go.
Is that the one? That's Boleyn, isn't it?
Anne Boleyn.
We're looking at something that you can't see.
It's a picture of Anne Boleyn, and then if you look...
Yes! Yes, it's true. Look it up. Who's the artist on that, so we can point people...
I don't know. I'll put it... If you look up Six Wives of Henry VIII's...
top left.
Top left.
There she is.
It does look...
Boleyn.
Yeah.
It could be. Yeah.
So luckily I wasn't around then.
Well, no, would have been good. Imagine what else... There weren't many good jobs back then. Being a Boleyn lookalike...
I would have got
probably been
loads,
good.
Yeah. I had to wear a bra with fake...
You know.
Everything was tied down then anyway, wasn't it? So.
Well, yeah, if you were an actor back then, you'd have to tie it all down and play women. Didn't allow women on the stage back then.
A lot more work to... Well...
Henry... Do you know what? Henry VIII was a really big fan of Morris dancing.
This... Maybe we have struck upon this show links in every single...
Every film I've ever made.
Yeah, it's a bit like
the,
it's sort of like
back.
A Kevin Bacon
element
to this.
Way of the Morris, available on Vimeo and also on DVD.
Please purchase a copy immediately. So we'll talk about three billboards then. So,
yes, I went to the premiere of that.
Is it weird going to premiere because they've obviously seen it loads of times and having is the reaction? Do you think is obviously it's put full for a start, and most cinema screens aren't full. And is everyone quite deferential and clapping? A lot more clapping, I imagine.
There was. It's interesting. I don't often go to... So it was at the Odeon Leicester Square. And I was up in the what do you call it?
Best seats?
No, it wasn't the best seats. But yeah, up in the gods. But in the second tier.
Okay.
In the balcony. So there's a lot of people in there.
Yeah.
And everyone's on their best behaviour. And there's a lot of people there who get dressed up.
Yeah.
And... probably haven't been to a film premiere before, so everyone wants to clap and laugh in all the right places, and it's a very different experience to just going to see the Ballad of Shirley Collins
with
the,
12 people down here,
12 people like you did, including a mad rich woman. You were saying,
I've got to say that some
posh woman kept shouting at the
mental
screen,
woman
talking
shouting
to
you,
the as if Shirley could hear her. But maybe we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about the other one. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's stay on track with.
So what?
Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah, I've only seen a few.
Not a real place.
I've been seeing a few sort of comedy festival films where it's been a really partisan crowd, and you automatically feel uplifted and think the film is probably a bit better than it is. Nonetheless, I think this is a absolutely fascinating film. So Martin McDonagh he's a playwright. There's a great podcast I listened to called on the way here called Colonel, which they interview him.
All right, yeah.
And he did In Bruges, which I love, Seven Psychopaths, which is all right, and he even talked about that being all him. Right. Not, yeah. He admits that film didn't go right. Three Billboards is sort of back up to the In Bruges standard, I think.
Well, it's actually the first film of his that I've seen, but I know his theatre work.
Oh, okay.
Because this kind of connects to what I was talking about when I was at Birmingham doing my MA 20 years ago, was when McDonagh first kind of broke on the scene. So I went to see his first film, which is called The Beauty Queen of Leanne, I think. And then there's another film called The Cripple of Inishmore. Both of those I saw back in the day when they were first on. And then he had a play on called Hangmen in Leicester Square about 2 or 3 years
ago. That's quite famous, wasn't it?
Some friends of mine were in that. So oh, really? I went to see that as well. So I've kind of followed his theatre career and been aware of his theatre work, but actually haven't dipped into his film stuff until Three Billboards, basically because I had a free ticket.
And they're similar. Can you tell? Can you say that's the same writer?
What I'm actually interested in, before you arrived, I was just looking it up, because his plays, certainly his early plays, are all set in rural Ireland. And his parents are Irish. He was born in Camberwell, I think, but he comes from Irish heritage. So his early plays were all about tapping into that, and it's a real rural quality to them, which I guess maybe appealed to me even then. If you look at what I've ended up doing now with the films that I've done about rural idylls, etc. I mean, actually, they're not idylls in his plays. They're quite dysfunctional. Mm. They're family units in the back end of Beyond in Ireland with the wind howling. But he wrote his first play that he wrote set in America. I can't remember what it's called, but I'm quite interested to maybe check that out.
Yeah.
I think what you get from Three Billboards, or what I got from it anyway, is there's a lot of talking in it for a film. And it feels like somebody. It doesn't always work. I don't think a playwright turning to film, but this did for me. But at the same time, it felt very written. But in a good way, it felt like somebody confident enough to write a tight, funny script. And yeah. It also felt like somebody, and maybe this comes from somebody who's worked in the theatre as well. It felt like a director who was very willing to give his performers a certain amount of rope, if you like, to kind of run with this.
I think that's what really interesting in this podcast beforehand. But I think you should, anyone should listen to that, because there's an interview with him saying that he doesn't really like theatre. And he just,
right,
because there's no permanence there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he admitted he wanted to create a sort of catalogue of work that he was proud of.
Yeah.
And he liked the fact that in Bruges you could show that to his kids in 20 years' time, and it would still be there.
Yeah.
And he was talking about working. He liked to work with the same actors and give them room. And he said he didn't give Colin Farrell any notes in Bruges.
Yeah.
And he said Francis McDormand. He said that it was quite difficult at times working with her, because she was quite stubborn.
Yes.
But he was talking about giving his actors that trust to perform. And the cast is...
It's a stellar cast.
Yeah. Everyone is. And they're just... Francis McDormand is amazing.
Yeah.
Sam Rockwell is amazing. Woody Harrelson is amazing. You know, yeah. Just... all the minor characters are all...
It's got...
Peter Dinklage is amazing.
Little Peter... Probably my only criticism of it is, and I don't mean this as a terrible pun, but I could have done with more Dinklage.
Yeah,
I thought it was slightly underused, the Dink.
And it felt like they made almost too much of the midget thing. Yeah. I just thought, I think it's, you wouldn't talk to someone, there's no way.
Because he lives in the town, they just must know him as that guy. They almost don't see him
as
a
in Bembridge growing up, there was a I mean, you can't say midget, can you say dwarf? I'm really sorry, I don't know what the etiquette is.
But
you first of all, you sort of notice them and think that then that's perfectly normal. just a person where I thought it was. He must have got pissed off thinking I'm being referred to as that old wayfarer.
He must long for the role where it just can just play a character and not have any reference to.
Well, in Game of Thrones, it sort of got to the point now. I think he's been instrumental. You just think there's no. You don't care about the fact.
Yeah.
In the first series, I sort of mentioned it a bit now. Yeah. And now you don't. You think, oh, I love that character. He's a brilliant character.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, you don't.
Which is great.
See him as a small person anymore.
Yeah, I think people have done. Yeah, so that's. I do agree with you that was the one thing for me. And what's the other thing is
John Hawkes is in it as well. He's one of my favourite actors.
Which one is he?
He plays the husband, or the ex-husband, the father of the.
Oh, he chooses some amazing films, doesn't he?
Hawks is just, yeah. I mean, most people don't know his name, but he pops up all over the place, and he's always excellent. And
he's in that Mary, maybe it's Maybelline.
That's
but
a great film. Yeah, yeah.
Mary Marley.
Is there a comma in that one? Are they in a field?
Mary Magdalene.
Maybe. Four of them. Martha.
Maybelline.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in that. He's brilliant in that. He was in Deadwood as well, the TV series.
He's an old actor who's got looks strangely young, but he's a. If you think of him as really Winter's Bone, is he in?
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Really skinny.
Winter's Bone.
Abnormally skinny man.
Yeah, he's almost the American Mackenzie Crook in that respect.
Yes.
He looks slightly kind of shrink wrapped. His skin has been slightly shrink wrapped onto his skeleton. Yeah.
So
anyway, yeah, John Hawkes. He's one of my favorites.
Everyone's brilliant in it, and also
he's got the kid in it who was in Manchester by the Sea as well, who I really like.
Yes, he's great. He plays a daughter. There's a guy who from Get Out in it, the young brother in Get Out. He plays the advertising guy.
Oh yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's really good, and for me, if it was quite. It started off, and I thought this is going to be a slow. I didn't realise it was Martin McDonagh. I didn't realise who the director was from the start.
Well, that's a good thing.
Which is great. Yeah. I thought this is going to three billboards. This is going to be a slow, sort of ponderous.
Just people putting up with paper pages.
Yeah, how much can this be on about this? But then a lot happens, a lot of action. He's not scared to turn up the drama on almost every single scene in it, really.
It's very untheatrical in that respect. You know, there's a lot of locations, a lot happens, it whips through. It's not, you know, two people in a room for 90 minutes
in
a traditional theatre play. There's a lot going on. And I read an interview with him where he talked about, and I loved this about him, and I think you get the feel from the film that we were talking earlier about how mainstream narrative films have become quite, you know, predictable. And this never quite feels like that. And I think he talked about the fact that he allowed. This is what you hear. You hear playwrights saying this a lot, but you never hear a scriptwriter say this. He said the characters surprised him with what they were going to do next. He didn't structure the film. He created the characters and the world, and then he was constantly surprised at what they wanted to say or what they wanted to do next. Which I remember the first time I remember reading Harold Pinter. When I was, you know, again 20, 25 years ago, he talked about that a lot. That if you get the ingredients right, the characters start talking to you. And you don't need to manipulate them. And he said the plotting of this film was very much came from. Oh right, you're going to do this next, are you? I didn't think you were. Are you going to go in and do that to the dentist?
Mm.
Yeah, of course you are. Brilliant. All right, we'll do that.
I felt genuinely surprised because I think without realising it, the more films you watch. The more you are, your brain gets trained into that three-act arc bullshit that you know what's going to happen at the end of it before it even starts. You know the 27-minute point, you know you feel bored without realising why you're bored.
You know at some point the Empire or the First Order, or whatever they're going to call themselves, are going to get some kind of big weapon which is going to destroy something but takes quite a long time to power up for some reason.
I mean,
enough time to power up for you, the rebels, to take it out. Just enough time, though.
Yeah, but there's no point at putting defences for small ships, like size of the bus ships, because what can they do?
No. I mean, if you look historically back
at
what those kind of small ships have done to not just one, but two Death Stars. Yep. Why would you set up then, in the future, some way of kind of...
But this super cannon only takes half an hour to build.
It's only half an hour.
There's no way they're going to get past... They'd need at least six spaceships.
I mean, they can jump to hyperspace, but it takes half an hour to fire this bad boy.
Yeah, but the brakes are really great in hyperspace. You can jump a million miles and you can stop within 2 or 3 meters. The braking system they've got is phenomenal.
Phenomenal,
when
isn't it? Yeah.
When we're doing those hyperspace brakes, stop. Really good. Yeah. I mean, the rubber must be at least.
They can stop so, it on a dime. Yeah, yeah.
That's good to know in the future. Anyway, so what
no,
did
in
you...
the past, though, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Did you enjoy it though? Did you think it was? Did you? What,
yeah,
what,
I did.
What
I did,
did you
I mean,
feel
I...
when you left the cinema?
I mean, I loved the ending for a start.
Oh really?
You come out. You don't. Some mainstream films don't end like that.
Yeah. I thought it felt like it was going to end about 3 or 4 times, and then it ended. That was one thing I thought, is this the ending? Is this, you could have ended it here, you could have ended it here, or are you going to end it?
I mean, I had, in, it was the last, it was the last film that I saw at
my
the festival.
Apologies.
And I think, if I'm honest about my response to it when I came out, and in fact, somebody stopped me afterwards that I know, there's an actor called Andy Nyman, who was actually in the McDonagh play, Hangmen, that was on. He was in the crowd that night as well, and he was buzzing after seeing it, and he stopped me and said, wow, it's amazing, wasn't it? And I think my memory of it was good, but yeah, it was a bit mainstream for me. But that was because I'd just spent 2 weeks at the film festival sniffing out the more obscure stuff that I knew wasn't going to get released. That's what I tend to do. I'll go and find the kind of the Uruguayan
low-budget
kind of thing about two blokes fishing in Montevideo for 90 minutes or one shot.
Was that good?
I'm making that one up. Well, that would be a good one. But yeah, so actually my initial response to it was, it was good, but it was a bit mainstream for my personal tastes. Which I probably still stand by, but
yeah.
if I'm going to sit and watch a mainstream film, then this is the one that I would choose to watch.
I really enjoy it.
I mean,
yeah.
I love Frances McDormand. I mean, she's just... anything she's in is worth your time. Have you seen a TV show she did called Olive Kitteridge?
I've read the HBO. Book.
HBO.
The book is brilliant.
She's brilliant. That's the one people when they talk about this film often talk about is, you know, it's the best thing she's done since Fargo. But in between those two things is Olive Kitteridge, which I haven't seen anyone else particularly talk about.
Oh, because I read the book and I thought, what an amazing character. I heard they've done it, but that. Oh, that
it's
must be brilliant because the book
yeah,
is absolutely brilliant,
yeah.
And so she must be.
She is brilliant in it. It's got, and again, it's got a really good cast in it. It's got Richard Jenkins in it. Do you know Richard Jenkins?
We talked about Richard Jenkins. My friend Beth talked about. He's a big fan of his. He is in The Shape of Water.
Yes, I'm looking forward.
He's the sort of person who's just now. People are just because I saw him in Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah,
and you see him, you think, oh, he's a guy who's always brilliant.
Yeah.
So he's been brilliant for about 20 years,
yes.
And now people are starting to say, for the first time,
Richard Jenkins, yeah.
Rather than, oh, that guy,
who
was that minor part in the thing that you're never really going to get leads, and then you think, I think he's so good.
Is he, so I haven't seen Shape of Water yet, without giving too much away, is he sat down a lot in it, or is he stood up?
No, Shape of Water... It's not. Do you need to get your phone?
No, we'll leave that to ring over there.
I saw a preview copy of it. I'm not going to talk about it. Maybe I'll talk about it in a few weeks.
Yeah,
okay. Basically.
But there was a period. What I'm saying is there was a period in Jenkins's work. I haven't seen his last few things. But there was one film I saw. I think I can't remember what it was called. I think James Gandolfini was in it as well. So you can kind of correlate those two and find this film. Jenkins is sat down in every scene, and it struck me as a man of a certain age who just said, do you know what, I think he sat down in this one. He was always in a bar, so somebody would come in to scenes and he'd already be in there sat at the bar. And then there was one scene where he was in a car and somebody came to him in the car, and I felt like that had been written like two people meet on a street and Jenkins had said, mate, I think maybe he's in a car, maybe. He's driven,
and the director hasn't got enough strength to say. But have you done that on set?
I could just be sat down again. I just think
I've done that on things which I've No, just when there's a costume thing and you realise, or you try not to have a glued moustache on.
Oh, if you can avoid that.
You just say, I think my character would not have it, would just be, or I think you would just be roughly shaven at this.
It looked just like me, probably, and wear my clothes.
Yeah, and anything really uncomfortable, costume, I mean, you do it not for your own benefit. I'm not saying, I don't think, if you know it's going to be really hot in some studio thing, I don't think he'd wear that. I think he just feels like he'd wear this.
So he might have shorts on, actually, I'm thinking for this.
I think he would drink, I think he'd get a coffee, this character, every half an hour. And he'd only say very small, but it's just facial reactions, really. I don't think he'd say that.
Too much dialogue. We should strip all this out, actually. I can do that in a look. You don't need to say any of that.
Yeah, okay, happy? All right, thanks. Bye.
I think Francis did that a bit with McDonough.
It'd be fascinating to see,
tried to strip
some
stuff out and just say, look, I don't need to say that. I can.
There's a bit where she's, show you that. Where she first sees the three billboards.
Yes.
And she's thinking about what to do. And it's, I always thought doing that, I always do way too much. If you can't control my face, like some girling twat. And seeing her thinking about it in the car without having to do overplaying it.
It's right at the top of the film. Yeah. It's great, yeah. Oh, one thing did you know that there was a bit in the film where there was a kind of sub theme of people getting stuff splattered in their face. It ran through.
Yeah, I didn't even think of it. Yeah,
the first thing that somebody gets in there. So Harrelson spits blood in her face.
Yeah.
So she gets something on her face. Then she flicks some Cheerios at the boy. So he gets something in the face. And there's one before somebody else gets something. And
you're right. There is a lot of face splatter.
What's all that about?
Might be some deviant stuff, isn't it? I don't know.
The third one. I can't remember what it is now. But they're in quite close proximity and kind of in the central part of the film.
Must
the
be some
of
sort
the
of
movie
theme.
There's a theme he's playing at with there, which I haven't quite got to grips with what the subtext of it is.
Why not write in? You can write in to dearfilmfandango@gmail.com. Click on contact on the filmfandango.co.uk website. You can follow us on Twitter, or you can follow. Are you on Twitter?
Yes,
you are.
At Way of the Morris.
At Way of the Morris or at Marek Glarwood.
I don't tweet very often, but yeah.
And how would you find out about the Ballad of Shirley Collins? Is there a website?
There's a website. It's called, I think it's called theballadofshirleycollins.com or shirleycollinsmovie.com. I think either of those will take you to the website. And there's a Facebook page.
I'll put a link to it on the Facebook page. How many Tims, this is what we do, give things marks out of 10. How many Tims out of 10 for the three billboards in the, not outside, three billboards, no, three boards
they
outside.
They are outside, but they're not in, they, I mean, they're, they are in the field, but it's not in the title.
Three billboards in the Ebbing, Missouri.
This is something I personally hate when you get it a lot when you go to film festivals.
Things.
No, you see, I'd almost hit people in cinema sometimes. This would have happened at Three Billboards when I saw it at the film festival, because you get a lot of critics are in there. The first thing they say to each other is the film, as the credits are going up, I'll give it that's probably about a 3.5.
You don't have to give it then. I'll give it a mark.
I'm going to say 7, and that's quite good for me.
I think I'll give it 8, Marek.
Yeah, I thought about 8 and I went that down. I backed off to 7.
I think it's a high
7.5.
I'll give it 8. I would go 8.3 or something. Anyway, thank you.
But please don't be rating films in that way.
That's what we've been doing for the last 5 years.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
And now I feel sordid.
When you spend
dirty.
3.5 years making a film, and somebody, the first thing they do is give it a mark out.
And that's what it is. Basically, your film is a number,
a decimal number.
Yeah,
give that a number out of 10. Move on to the next thing.
People have to categorise things, though, to understand them, I think.
Don't they, yeah.
Well, on that melancholy note...
I'm not judging you.
I deserve to be judged. And judged poorly. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you.
And remember, everyone, keep watching the films.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.